You're listening to the Space Show with Andrew Rennie. This evening, we bring you the second of four programs devoted to the International Space Station. Initially, we were going to have just three programs in the series, but it's now been extended out to the four. Now, program one last week gave a broad oversight of the space station, then zoomed in to examine some of the lesser known features of the space station operations. This program is a celebration of the first 10 years of human occupation of what has grown to be the largest structure ever assembled in space. It will also highlight the international cooperation involved. Program 3 will take stock of the current status of the station and bring to your attention some of the exciting developments that will happen later this year. Program 4 is both a look back at the first 10 years of space station operations and a peek forward to the future of mankind's orbital outpost, and also includes statements by Charlie Bolden at a hearing in the United States Senate. Now, as with last week's program, we will begin with the Beatles tribute band Love and Mersey performing Back in the ISS. Yes, you heard right, Back in the ISS, not Back in the USSR. And we invite you to pay close attention to the lyrics. The first part is in English, and later they switch over to singing in Dutch.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. 4, 3, 2, 1, top.
We'll be right back.
Music and lyrics by Jan Hovers. That was the Beatles tribute band Love and Mercy. And a great thank you to the listeners who did point out that last week I mispronounced Jan's name. The International Space Station is the largest structure ever assembled in space. It is as big as a football pitch and has now been continuously inhabited for more than 10 years. Construction of the International Space Station is very near completion, and this has required many nations with disparate technical cultures to cooperate. This feature highlights that multinational cooperation.
Spacecraft takes just about everything technical in the encyclopedia. You have to build a little microcosm out there, and everything that it takes to be a functioning human being on the ground, you have to replicate out there. When you decide to do it internationally, then it truly does become a representation of the Earth from which we come. And so we bring all of our problems, requiring all the solutions with us. Whether it's environmental or food or political or financial, we all have to face it. So this becomes a little laboratory, a testing ground where we can do that.
I think the benefits of working together internationally are that we bring together the advantages, the pluses of all the various nations, and we together are bigger than we are as the sum of individuals.
60 years ago, people in Europe were fighting one another. Now they're working together, working on spacecraft and space stations. 2 decades ago, the Cold War was still going on, and here we are working with the Russians, the Americans, the Japanese, the Europeans, everybody working together, and it seems that it's a far better thing to be doing than we were doing 60 years ago.
At some point in time, we were enemies, but with this great project, it was possible to bring all of those people together and not speak the same language, but basically speak the same language of space, so we can have the same goal and the same objective.
It involves so many different cultures, not just people culture, but space cultures, and they're all very different. And so that the biggest challenge is getting everybody to appreciate and understand how these all work together. Technically, we're all very smart people. You know, physics is physics, and we're going to solve problems. But getting everybody to overcome the boundaries of the cultures, both people and space cultures, is a big challenge.
It's a challenge for humanity, not just for 15 nations. I think it's the sum of the work of all humanity working together that made it possible to achieve such a project. The sum of our knowledge, scientific and technical knowledge, was required to achieve that project.
Well, for the European Space Agency, working internationally is our way of doing business anyway. We have 17 member states, and we're used to the idea of cooperating. It's our modus operandi. But extending that to working with the Americans, the Canadians, the Japanese, and the Russians is that much bigger a challenge, of course, and that much bigger of an opportunity. It gives us the chance to do programs that we couldn't do all by ourselves, and it gives us the chance to learn how different people work, how different cultures work together, and how we can cooperate and produce something as magnificent as the ISS.
The beginning of space station. The FGB was a signature element almost of this international cooperation. It was a Russian-built module, but it was built for the U.S. It was launched in Kazakhstan. So just to begin with, that one module was an international module before it ever got to orbit. It was an international effort.
Нам никуда не деться от того, чтобы делать крупные проекты, потому что чем больше, чем крупнее проект, чем более
Well, it is our destiny to do big projects, because the bigger the challenge and the more complex the integration of hardware, the more we'll need specialists in many different fields. And those specialists will come from many different countries. In the future, we'll need to integrate together people from different disciplines in different countries. Otherwise, we'll be doomed to work only on simple basic issues.
Поэтому, да, какие-то элементы могут делаться независимо, но все-таки...
It's always difficult to work with a big team because everybody has a unique perspective, a unique way of doing business, a unique way of working. We all bring different capabilities, different views, and it's not different than any other big team project where you have thousands and thousands of people working together. We all have to learn that we have specific things to bring in the project, that we're bringing unique capabilities and expertise.
Such a big project as the ISS, because of the high technology requirement and also the large amount of money to develop and operate the station, I believe that only one country is not enough to build and operate the station.
No country has the political will to really push the exploration the way it needs to be pushed. It would take a tremendous amount of effort for any one country to go forward and to push in these areas and to do exploration to the moon and Mars, or to even do space station. It would be impossible for any single country to do what we're doing here on space station. But as a team, we have to give up a little something. We have to give up some of our own nationalistic interests a little bit, but we're pulling for a higher good, and that higher good is to learn to explore, to learn to push frontiers, to learn to move out, and that's really what cooperation brings us. And I can't think of a better example than Space Station when you look forward.
One of the great positives has been the way that we have been able to work together in times of great difficulty.
Their implication is much broader than the International Space Station. When you ask a question about the challenges associated with that and the benefits associated with that, if you reach to the very basic answer to that question, to me it's as simple as when countries learn to work together, it's like working together with your friends, working together with your co-workers at work.
I believe that the level of mutual understanding and trust was impacted dramatically. It improved in leaps and bounds.
At
the end of the training, my crew members were telling me that they knew what I was going to say even before I had finished speaking, because we had such a good level of understanding. It didn't matter whether I was speaking Russian or English, we just understood each other. We understood each other even better than we understood our managers, because we as crewmates were facing the same challenges, the same difficulties, the same problems, and we were looking at things from the same perspective.
I think the enthusiasm generated by this combined effort of so many different nations at the operational level is one of the things that can send chills up your spine.
Today, when I think of the ISS, what really waters my eyes is really amazing to me and exciting to me is the international cooperation and the level of the international cooperation.
Those nights when I get to go out and watch the space station fly over, I'm very proud of the accomplishment, not only of this country and this agency, but of all the countries that have participated, because it is such a basic achievement to our survival of the human species in the future.
This is really the key to the future, to learn how to operate internationally, to make those trades, to make those decisions, to do the best thing, not just for one country, but for the overall good of all the partners that are participating. That will be the real challenge as we move forward to more dynamic and more challenging environments, even beyond space station.
One of the things I love about coming to work here is that I will have the opportunity to greet people in several different languages during the day. You don't necessarily know when you go to the coffee pot if you'll be hearing English, French, Italian, German, Russian, and Japanese. It's all spoken here. And it's almost like a little United Nations, Starfleet Academy comes to mind. The sense that this is a united project where it doesn't really matter about your cultural origins. This is something fundamental to the species.
On the Space Show, we are listening to part two of a four-part series featuring the International Space Station. And we'll be back with that in just a few moments.
Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Why don't we just try that again? And because I missed the beginning of it.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Now that the space station assembly is nearly complete, attention is now turning to the scientific objectives. The European Space Agency's Frank De Win, a Belgian astronaut, explains the science being done on the International Space Station in this feature prepared for us by the European Space Agency.
Some of our scientific modules that we have on board of the International Space Station in our labs, like the Columbus Lab or like the Kibo Lab, we have a lot of capabilities to do science, both in fluid science, material science, biology, and we're going to have a full complement of international scientific experiments in all of these disciplines that should help us better understand how certain things work here on Earth, but that can also help us in exploring further the solar system. One of the big advantages of six-person crew is that you have less people that will need to be occupied with maintaining the station, so we have more people available for doing science and utilization. And we already see this in Expedition 16, for example, for which I was a backup. We had about 80 hours of science in the entire expedition. For Expedition 2021, we are looking for more than 1,000 hours of science and utilization. So this is a huge increase that we are seeing because of going to six-person crew. The disciplines I like, for example, in science are technology experiments, because as an engineer, that is what my background is. Of course, I will also do a lot of medical experiments together with my crewmate Bob Tursk, who is a medical doctor. And otherwise, of course, I'm very much looking forward to all the operational tasks, especially the robotics tasks that I will have during my stay.
Months will be to prepare for future space exploration, where also there will be more and more people flying to space. We have a lot of fun in our crew. We also work very hard together, so I think whatever we do and whatever we set out will be the lead for future space exploration of our solar system.
Yes. astronauts first entered the nascent space station when it consisted of only two modules, Zarya from Russia and Unity from the United States. That was in 1998 December. During 2000, other astronauts visited for a few days at a time. Then, in 2000 November, the first permanent crew arrived. The three astronauts, one American and two Russians, constituted Expedition 1. The station has been continuously inhabited since. At present, the six-person Expedition 30 crew is aboard. The following feature was prepared by NASA to mark 10 years of continuous habitation of the space station.
For centuries, people have gazed at the night sky and imagined what it might be like to live among the stars. What would it be like to look back at Earth from a permanent home in space? Would we see borders between countries? Could we see the seasons change? Could we eat and breathe and sleep and work? How would we feel? And how would our bodies react with no gravity to hold us in place? Do the laws of science behave in space as they do on Earth? How can we answer these questions, and what do they mean for the people of Earth? Since November 2000, not a day has passed without humans in space, orbiting more than 200 miles above our planet. They live and work and conduct scientific research to answer these questions and many more like them. They are scientists, but also construction workers and technicians, repairmen and teachers, cleaners and cooks. During the past decade, 15 nations have come together, setting aside boundaries and differences to design, assemble, occupy, and conduct research inside and outside of the largest and longest inhabited object to ever orbit the Earth. This is the story of their efforts. This is the story of the International Space Station. As early as the 19th century, writers and artists and scientists around the world began to publish their visions of a crewed outpost in space. In 1869, author Edward Everett Hale penned The Brick Moon, a short story about a satellite built from 12 million bricks. At the turn of the 20th century, Russian scientist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky proposed ideas about human spaceflight, including an orbiting space station. In 1923, Romanian math teacher Hermann Oberth published a treatise that included an orbiting refueling station for a manned trip to Mars. A few years later, in 1929, Austrian engineer Hermann Nordung wrote of a giant wheel-shaped platform that rotated to produce artificial gravity. One of Oberth's students was famed rocketeer Wernher von Braun, who in late 1945 developed a concept for a modular, wheel-like space station that would serve as a launching point for a mission to the moon. In 1952, von Braun published a widely read series of articles about space travel in Collier's magazine. In the early 1960s, as human spaceflight programs in the United States and Russia took shape, engineers and designers began to investigate a variety of space station concepts based on then-current technology. The Soviets were the first to establish an orbiting space station, Salyut 1, launched in 1971. In 1973, Skylab was assembled from unused Apollo rocket parts and launched to become America's first orbiting space station.
Three crews flew aboard Skylab for a total of 171 days on orbit, conducting a variety of scientific experiments and observations that demonstrated the value and the potential for space-based research. A temporary space station was created when an American Apollo Command Module spacecraft docked with a Russian Soyuz ship on July 17, 1975. Apollo Soyuz was a viable example of international cooperation, the keystone in the foundation of the global partnership that would result in the construction of the International Space Station. With the launch of the first space shuttle on April 12, 1981, America resumed flying men and women into space.
We can follow our dreams to distant stars, living and working in space for peaceful economic and scientific gain.
In his 1984 State of the Union address, President Ronald Reagan announced the construction of a permanently crewed space station. 11 nations signed a formal agreement with NASA to participate in the development and construction of Space Station Freedom. In February 1986, the Soviets began construction of their modular space station, Mir. By October 1990, congressional budget changes mandated a complete redesign of the Space Station Freedom project with an emphasis on affordability. In 1993, NASA was directed to maximize the new station's scientific capabilities and leverage Russia's considerable experience in space station operations by inviting Russian participation in the American Space Station project. The result was a global partnership of 15 countries that learned to work through differences in culture, language, politics, design, manufacturing, management, and operational styles. During phase one of the space station program, between February 1994 and June 1998, space shuttles made 11 visits to Mir, and 7 NASA astronauts lived aboard the Russian station. The experience gained from this series of flights was invaluable and set the stage for the design, development, and construction of the greatest engineering project in the history of mankind, a state-of-the-art research laboratory orbiting our planet. The International Space Station is the largest, most complex object ever assembled in space, and is clearly visible from Earth with nothing more than the naked eye. From end to end, the station is slightly longer than an American football field.
The biggest shock, I would say, the biggest impact that I had during my flight is the first time I looked out the window of the orbiter and saw the space station. It was huge. It was huge and shiny and beautiful. And looking at it and knowing that a man-made structure that big is actually up there.
The interior of this incredible structure is larger than a 5-bedroom house, with 2 baths, a gym, and a 360-degree bay window. The station's mass is almost 1 million pounds, and it contains about 32,000 cubic feet of living space. The space station functions as a microgravity and life sciences laboratory, a test bed for new technologies, and as a platform for both Earth and celestial observations. The complex is made up of multiple interconnected modules, grouped together at the center point of a 357-foot-long integrated truss structure. Power is generated through 4 giant solar arrays attached to the ends of the truss. The pressurized components include 3 laboratories: the U.S. Laboratory Module Destiny, the European Research Laboratory Columbus, and the Japanese Experiment Module Kibo. The Russian Service Module is the structural and functional center of the Russian segment of the station. It provides living quarters, communication systems, an exercise facility, and flight propulsion systems. Other Russian segments include the functional cargo block, 2 mini research modules, and a docking compartment. The Italian Space Agency provided a permanent multi-purpose module, which can host up to 16 additional racks containing equipment, experiments, and supplies. There are three modules called nodes that connect the elements of the station and provide berthing ports. The primary residential areas include the Russian service module and Node 3 Tranquility, which contains a bathroom for crew hygiene and exercise equipment, a treadmill, and a zero-G weightlifting device. The Quest airlock provides the capability for extravehicular activity, or EVAs. This is the module that provides the exit for spacewalking astronauts to go outside the station to work. The Cupola is a small module designed for the observation of operations outside the space station. Similar to a bay window in a home on Earth, but with a 360-degree view, the Cupola allows crew members to observe the approach of vehicles, as well as all robotic arm operations and spacewalks. The Canadian-built space station robotic arm is a larger version of the arm on the space shuttle and is used to move equipment and hardware around outside the station. The space station is the home of six full-time crew members and is made up of astronauts and cosmonauts from nations around the world. More than 200 people have visited so far, and at least another 120 will live there over the next decade. The International Space Station is an unprecedented technological and political achievement to conceive, plan, build, operate, and use a research platform in space. It is the latest step in humankind's quest to explore and live in space. But its greatest accomplishment is as much a human achievement as a technological one. The Global Partnership of Space Agencies exemplifies meshing of cultural differences and political intricacies to plan, coordinate, construct, and operate the complex elements of a space station.
It involves so many different cultures, not just people culture, but space cultures, and they're all very different. The biggest challenge is getting everybody to appreciate and understand how these all work together.
The program brings together not only international flight crews, but also globally distributed launch, operations, training, engineering, management, communications networks, and scientific research communities.
When countries learn to work together, it's like working together with your friends, working together with your co-workers at work. We tend to become closer, we tend to understand each other better. We've been very, very successful. So at night, those nights when I get to go out and watch the space station fly over, I'm very proud of the accomplishment, not only of this country and this agency, but of all the countries that participated.
The space station's modular design was dictated in part by the launch vehicle payload bay size of the space shuttle and the need to make components maintainable, replaceable, and sized to fit through a hatch. Each of the components that make up the station was designed, engineered, and built in manufacturing facilities and factories in countries around the world and assembled piece by piece for the first time in space.
When I talk to folks all over, I mention that none of these parts have been put together on Earth, and I think they all stop and go, wow, that's pretty incredible, because when they get up to space, they all magically fit together, which means the cooperation on the engineering and technical side is really working.
Building the International Space Station required 36 space shuttle flights and 5 Russian Proton rocket launches to ferry each space station component into orbit. Working in a dangerous and hostile environment while orbiting the Earth at 17,500 miles per hour, spacewalking astronauts and robotic arm operators carefully assembled the components. In elegantly choreographed ballets, Astronauts operating the space shuttle's arm and the space station's arm lifted the station modules and trusses from the shuttle's payload bay and maneuvered them into place. Astronauts and cosmonauts in pressurized spacesuits then attached the components to the station during nearly 160 spacewalks.
The International Space Station is a little bit more unique because people are actually living and working up in space 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And what that means is that there's a myriad of people on the ground all over the world making sure that every aspect of that spacecraft is working correctly and the crew on board is healthy and safe.
Ground operations for and management of the International Space Station are like running a marathon, not a sprint. Overall coordination of space station operations takes place at the Christopher C. Kraft Jr. Mission Control Center in Houston, Texas, and the Russian Mission Control Center outside Moscow. These control centers oversee the U.S. and Russian segments of the space station. At each control center, a team of flight controllers is assigned to monitor each of the different systems and research facilities aboard the space station. The flight controllers answer to the flight director, the leader of the flight team, and the person responsible for overall mission success. The flight director communicates with the station crew through the CAPCOM, or spacecraft communicator. The CAPCOM is frequently an astronaut. To provide round-the-clock systems monitoring and also flight crew access to the ground team at all hours, three rotating sets of flight directors and controllers work an overlapping 9-hour shift in an intricate schedule covering all 24 hours of the day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. As the space station has expanded with equipment and crew launches from Florida and Kazakhstan, other launch centers and module control centers have been added to the global space station family. There are additional control centers in Huntsville, Alabama, and St. Hubert in Canada. The European Space Agency operates locations in France, French Guiana, and Oberpfaffenhofen, Germany. The Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency manages its operations at two sites within its home country. During the assembly phase, the space shuttle and the Russian Soyuz spacecraft have been the workhorses to deliver space station supplies and research samples, and later crew members to and from the space station. Supplies are also delivered to the station by unpiloted spacecraft. The Russian Progress, JAXA's H-2 Transfer Vehicle, or HTV, and ESA's Automated Transfer Vehicle, or ATV. After NASA has retired the space shuttle, astronauts will catch rides in the Russian Soyuz spacecraft to continue the U.S. presence aboard the station. U.S. commercial spacecraft, currently in development, will eventually deliver astronauts and supplies to the station. Each flight aboard the International Space Station, called an expedition, lasts about 6 months. Similar to a temporary overseas assignment back on Earth, astronauts communicate with their families by telephone, email, or the Internet, but are still away from home for an extended period of time. This rotating mixture of astronauts and cosmonauts, representing five different space agencies, trains between 2 and 4 years prior to launch. The training facilities for astronauts and cosmonauts are located in Texas, Russia, Canada, Germany, and Japan. The habitation and life support systems provide a safe, comfortable, and livable environment in which crew members can conduct scientific research. The amenities include quarters for eating, sleeping, and exercising, environmental controls, medical and health support, and computing and data management. There is also a state-of-the-art recycling system that scrubs the air and liquid waste for reuse. But what is it like to move to space and live 240 miles above the Earth for months at a time? Crew members exercise to maintain muscle and bone strength, communicate with family and friends back on Earth, spend time sightseeing, and get together for dinner.
And we're sitting there having a meal with Russians, Germans, French, American, African American, Asian American, this whole melting pot of people working together for the common good of our civilization.
Of course, living in microgravity is not all work, no play. Although the station is equipped with two bathrooms, bathing can present a challenge.
When you're up living on the International Space Station, you might be 6 months without a real shower. Essentially, you have a sponge bath is what you do every day. And yeah, you do get pretty sweaty because you're working out. But surprisingly enough, when the shuttle crew came to pick me up, it was one of my first questions, do I smell? And they said I didn't smell, and they said my hair didn't look greasy, so I was pretty happy with that.
Well, the gee whiz thing is the zero gravity. Having a long-term laboratory with zero gravity is very unique, and I think it's one that I hope that we will reap the benefits from in the future from a scientific perspective in a much more active way.
As soon as the station was habitable, astronauts began to study the impact of microgravity and other space effects on the human body, other life forms, fluids, and materials. Over 10 years of continuous research, more than 500 experiments have been conducted on the space station while it was under construction. The space station is a state-of-the-art research laboratory that advances our knowledge of human physiology, biology, and material and physical science. This knowledge translates into medical, economic, and environmental benefits for the people of Earth. Research on the station found that Salmonella bacteria, a leading cause of food poisoning worldwide, grows faster and becomes more infectious in space. The findings already have led to a candidate vaccine, which, if proven, could save lives around the world. Salmonella is the third highest cause of infant death worldwide, and its potentially lethal effects are one of the most common forms of food poisoning in America. Outside the station, sustained by its large solar power supply, is a silent explorer sifting through space. Called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, it is finding and tracking exotic particles of antimatter and dark matter in cosmic rays from distant galaxies. The results could change our basic understanding of the universe. Other research aboard station has led to the design and development of tiny microballoons, which help get drugs directly to specific cancer cells. The station is also used as an education platform to encourage and motivate today's youth to pursue careers in math, science, engineering, and technology, enabling them to become the leaders and space explorers of tomorrow. In addition, researchers aboard the space station will gain knowledge about human physiology, radiation, material science, engineering, biology, fluid physics, and technology that will help people on Earth and enable future space exploration missions. This high-flying international laboratory is packed with some of the most sophisticated facilities ever designed. There is no single place on Earth where a laboratory like this can be found. And in 2005, Congress designated the space station as an official U.S. national laboratory. This has opened up the station and provided opportunities for additional research from other agencies, universities, middle and high school students, and private companies. Scientists from all over the world are using facilities aboard the station. Several patents and partnerships already have demonstrated the value and benefits of space-based research. Future space station experiments and their applications on Earth are in the making, and the promise and possibilities are endless.
the ISS is the greatest human endeavor ever in the history of the world in terms of complexity and the challenges that are brought with that complexity.
Two decades ago, the Cold War was still going on, and here we are working with the Russians, the Americans, the Japanese, the Europeans, everybody working together, and it seems that it's a far better thing to be doing than we were doing 60 years ago. It gives us the chance to do programs that that we couldn't do all by ourselves, and it gives us the chance to learn how different people work, how different cultures work together, and how we can cooperate and produce something as magnificent as the ISS.
Like stepping on stones across a stream, humans have started to take small steps across the universe. In the stream of time, the International Space Station is just one small step. All the lessons, good and bad, that we learn on Space Station will benefit us as we look toward longer missions away from Earth. Some of the biggest lessons learned from the design, development, and assembly of the International Space Station are those of peaceful cooperation among nations.
It would be impossible for any single country to do what we're doing here on Space Station. But as a team, we're pulling for a higher good, and that higher good is to learn to explore, to learn to push frontiers, to learn to move out. And that's really what cooperation brings us. And I can't think of a better example than Space Station when you look forward.
Humans will continue to explore in low Earth orbit, on journeys back to the Moon, to Mars, to asteroids, and beyond. But wherever we go, the International Space Station is improving our lives on Earth now and cementing our first real foothold for working and living in space.
That documentary was prepared to celebrate 10 years of permanent occupation of the International Space Station. And that brings us near the end of the second space show highlighting mankind's outpost in space. On the next week's show, we examine the current status of the International Space Station and look at its future, the science being done aboard, and how to get cargo up to the post. Up to the station in the post-shuttle era. We also have Charlie Bolden explaining the biomedical effects of long-duration flight. Turns out there are some problems. Well, this four-part series is researched, written, and presented by Andrew Rennie. And we'll go out as we did on last week's show with Pink Martini, which is a musical group that will be familiar to many of you. Last year, they dedicated a song to Italian astronaut Paolo Nespoli and Russian cosmonaut Alexander Kaleri. These astronauts were aboard the space station when the second European Space Agency's automated transfer vehicle docked with the station. And that vehicle was called the Johannes Kepler and brought several tons of cargo, fuel and air to the station. So let's go out then with a little bit of Pink Martini.
I'm China Forbes, and on behalf of the band Pink Martini, we'd like to send best wishes to the entire crew of the International Space Station, and especially astronaut Paolo Nespoli from Italy and Russian cosmonaut Alexander Kaleri. This week, Paolo and Alexander have a crucial task to oversee the docking of ESA's ATV cargo vessel, Johannes Kepler. It's a job that requires teamwork and cooperation between the astronauts in space and specialists from many nations on the ground. And all of us here at Pink Martini will be watching closely. Today we'd like to dedicate one of our favorite songs to both of you. It's called Do Spidania Mio Bambino. It's about Russia, Italy, winter, summer, and love. Even if you're a long way from home, you're in our hearts. Best wishes from Pink Martini.
The samovar is full of tea. You stare unblinkingly at me while your car waits in the freezing rain. I know your soul calls Moscow home, but your heart belongs to Rome. So for years I followed you in vain. But oh, will you ever know what you when we miss the naked trees of Gorky Park.